Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the HJ2 Proposed Rule Task Force for Group 2. I'm Seth Pazinski with the HHS Assistant Secretary for Technology Policy, and I'll be serving as your designated federal officer for today. As a reminder, this meeting is open to the public, and we encourage public feedback throughout the meeting, and comments can be made via the Zoom chat feature. Also, we have time scheduled for verbal public comments towards the end of our agenda for today. And so we're going to kick things off with a roll call. And when I call your name, if you could please indicate that you are present. So I'll start with our co-chair, Mark Sendak.
Present.
Suresh Ballou. Hans Boutendijk.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Steve Eichner.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Raj Gudvarchi. Mary Beth Carrillo.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon. Hun Liu.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Meg Marshall.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello. Alex Muggy. Shantana Nunde. Dan Riskin, Bill Sutherland, Naresh Sundar Rajan.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And Cheryl Turney.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Is there anyone I missed or who just joined us that would like to announce themselves? Okay. Well, I'm going to turn things over to our co-chair, Mark Sendak, for his opening remarks.
So, thank you, everyone. We are getting close to the end. I know that today is our second to last meeting where we're going to be going through specific recommendations in the worksheet. One thing that we will try to do as well is if we have time to go back and fill out some of the initial ones also that we didn't get to in our first few meetings. So hopefully between this meeting and the meeting we have next week, we can at least compile recommendations for as many of the proposed rule changes as we can. So appreciate everyone's time. We'll go to the next slide just to reorient on the task force charge. So overarching charge for the task force is to evaluate and provide draft recommendations to HTI2 specific charge. And once again, we are the certification subgroup, is to provide recommendations on the proposals for the certification content. And we're on a schedule to, we're gonna meet this week, next week, try to finish going through all the recommendations at that point and then present to High Tech in early September. Next slide. So today we have not as many topics as we've had in some of our prior meetings. That's why we're gonna try to go through these two for electronic prescribing, real-time prescription benefit certification. And then if we have time, try to revisit some of the items from earlier in the course of our meetings. Next slide. Thank you.
Okay. And so we will now turn it over to Alex Baker, who's going to give us a brief presentation on the revised e-prescribing and real-time prescription benefit certification criteria. Alex, over to you.
Great. Thanks, Seth. My name is Alex Baker. I am Deputy Director of the Federal and State Tribal Local and Territorial Division in the Office of Policy for ASTP, and just give a quick teeing up of these two proposal areas in HTI2. So next slide. So first, we have a revision to the electronic prescribing certification criterion, which is in 170.315B. That has, of course, been in the certification program for some time. This proposed update to the criterion incorporates NCPDP script standard version 2023-011 into the criterion. So updating from the script standard version 2017-071, which was finalized in the Cures Act final rule. The timing of this update is that developers would be able to be certified to the version of the criterion using 2017-071 or the new version of the criterion using 2023-011 up until December 31st, 2027. And then as of January 1st, 2028, only certification that would be available would be that referencing the new script standard version 2023-011. In addition to the update in the standard, there are a number of other proposed updates to the transactions in the electronic prescribing criterion. Would note that perhaps the most significant set of proposals is around removing transactions that are currently identified as optional for the criterion. So the proposed rule discusses that there has been minimal uptake among developers for these criteria, for these transactions that were identified as optional. And so we have proposed to remove those optional criteria or optional transactions from the criterion and request comment on those proposals. We'll also just note among the other proposals related to the transactions in the criterion, we have proposed to make a set of transactions in the script standard around electronic prior authorization required. So those are moving from, those were previously optional after the final policy in the Cures Act final rule, and we are proposing to require certification to those transactions as part of certification to this criterion. We also propose to include the electronic prescribing criterion in the base definition, and that is related to the next proposal. So I'll hold on that for a moment to talk about that on the next slide. But in general, you know, the benefits of these proposals, e-prescribing continues to be a core functionality for certified health IT. And we are doing these revisions in tandem with the Part D program that also adopted script standard version 2023-011 for Part D plans in a final rule that was just recently released. So as we have done in previous years, we are working in tandem with Part D to ensure that updates to the script standard are done in both of our programs at the same time. Next slide. So the other new proposal here is for a new certification criterion that is the real-time prescription benefit certification criterion, which we proposed to add in 173.15b4. And this would enable exchange of patient eligibility, product coverage, and benefit financials for a chosen product and pharmacy, and to identify coverage restrictions and alternatives when they exist. We'll just note, the background for this criterion, this motivated by a provision in the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021, which amended the qualified EHR definition, which is an important statutory provision for the certification program and serves as the basis for what we now refer to as the base EHR definition, to add to that qualified EHR definition this functionality around real-time benefit tools in tandem, again, with requirements for the Part D program that were included in that law. And so this proposal to adopt this criterion is motivated both by wanting to support this useful functionality across developers, as well as staying supporting functionality in the Part D program from the provider side, but that this is also a statutory requirement that we are implementing through this proposed criterion. Some of the specifics here, we are proposing to reference NCPDP's real-time prescription benefit standard version 13 as the standard that is the basis for this criterion. That is, again, in tandem with the Part D requirements that have been finalized by CMS for their requirements for Part D plans to stand up real-time benefit tools to use for prescribers. As I noted, the statutory provision that is important here was an amendment to the qualified EHR definition, which is the basis for what is now referred to in our regulations as the base EHR definition. And so this certification criteria needs to be added to the base EHR definition as we are reading what we need to do to implement the law here. Because we added this to the base EHR definition, we have also proposed to add the electronic prescribing criterion to the base EHR definition that has previously not been included in the base EHR definition. And the proposed rule talks about doing that based on how intertwined these capabilities are for certified health IT, and that believed it would make sense to include e-prescribing functionality if we were also including this real-time prescription benefit functionality that is based on prescribing workflow. But there are questions in the proposed rule as well about that proposal and inviting comment on whether the linking of those two criteria in the base EHR definition is appropriate. So sort of broader benefits here, we believe that this proposed criterion can enable prescribers to assist patients with understanding the financial impacts associated with different prescriptions, and that the ability to understand this information at the point of care can ensure patients receive the right medication and address affordability issues when a medication is prescribed. So that is just the very high level introduction of these two proposals, and happy to point folks to elements in the proposed rule as necessary.
So does anyone have any questions on the slides? Hans.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question around the prior auth enhancements as part of the one of the criteria. And that is currently focusing on the provider side, but seems not to focus on the payer pharmacy side as well, where the workflow would be involved in. Is that understanding of the reading correct? And if so, what plans are there to the extent that you can address that, that side would be addressed as well? We are seeing within prior auth for non-prescriptions that there's a payer and a provider side. We see in public health, there is a provider and a public health side. We see that that's getting ingrained more into the approach. but that's not in this particular case. So trying to understand a little bit of the background and making sure that I'm not missing anything there.
So we'll just note that the Part D program does require for Part D plans that they support those e-prior auth transactions in the script standard. That is a final rule from uh 2022, something like that. I can add that citation in. But so there is while this certification criterion is focused more on the prescriber side, there is a corresponding piece in the Part D program related to this. Well, so just for folks' awareness.
And that's both for payers and pharmacies.
Alex.
Yeah, it applies to Part D plan sponsors, which is what they regulate. Let me just take a look at that rule again. But feel free to move on.
I think that's clarity enough for now, Mark. I'm good with that for the moment.
Sounds good. Any other questions from any of the task force members? Okay. So if not, I think the next step is for us to go back to the workbook.
Okay, I'll bring it up. Just give me one second. Okay, can everyone see my screen?
Yep.
Okay, thanks. And I'm gonna ask Asel to set the timer for 15 minutes.
And Sarah, is that for one of the rows? I just wanna make sure we're oriented too. So we're on rows 38, 39, and 40 for today?
Yes, it'll be 15 minutes for each topic. And we can start with either one. They're kind of reversed from how the presentation was given. So
let's maybe start with 40.
Okay. All right.
Okay. I don't see anything in row G for this, but any task force member proposed changes?
Let me raise my hand.
Yeah, go ahead, Hans.
Not sure what I'm looking at the exact, but the electronic prescribing relative to the point before. I think one of the things that we should consider recommending is that, as in other criteria, there has been this two-sided pairing of criteria that are established for the provider and for the other side, the payer, the public health, whatever, that would be helpful in this instance as well, particularly as we're expanding to prior auth. And it would be good practice across the board to perhaps separate that and have clear payer side responsibility clarity as well.
So just to make sure I understand, it's to have similar sets of recommendations for the payer and for the provider?
Yeah, so we have here, we have provider side requirements, and it would be helpful to extend the practice that is starting to also have criteria for the other side of the equation of the workflow. And then clearly other programs might have the appropriate level that they can enforce or not, but it would progress the approach that ONC started to introduce.
Mm-hmm.
So are you thinking, this is Steve Eitner, are you thinking in terms of potentially making a suggestion that the language might be amended to, rather than just sending, but sending and receiving?
Not in the same criteria, other than that, having the responsibilities in the workflow of what's on the provider side, what's on the payer side, akin to, for example, G3435. It's the prior auth from a provider perspective, and it's a prior auth from the payer perspective. So they have responsibilities on either side. It's starting to make that more clear. And then enforcement and use of it and reference of it is clearly, that's other programs, but it would create a common practice to make that clear and also be able to address consistency there.
Yeah, I'm supportive of the concept. I was just thinking about it from an implementation side, because it's similar to the public health reception side. And I was also thinking about whether there was a need to support exchange between healthcare providers for this information, because here again, looking at some of the prescription orders, it would seem that pharmacists would want to be able to receive the information as well.
And that's a great point. Would agree is that when we say pharmacy or pharmacist, what is their role in the exchange of this flow as well? So do they receive it, or do they send anything, or do they otherwise? So I think as we progress this, having role-specific criteria for the same capability in essence would help clarify and in at least A, understanding what's my responsibility, and B, for other programs to use that to get more systems consistently adopting that.
Right, and that's why I was thinking, again, it may have been an incorrect thought on my part, but that's why I was thinking it might have been send and receive in this particular criterion, because the HIT modules might be used, or the certified HIT modules might be used both by a entity ordering prescriptions as well as the entity receiving the prescription order.
I would agree with that, but one of the challenges is that with using the more client-server send-receive terminology, is that that might mean that at times there is then an implication that the same role needs to support both, versus if you do it role-based, then at that point in time, if a system happens to support multiple roles, they would support multiple capabilities and perspectives. And that seems to be easier for HIT to understand if I'm supporting a ordering provider versus a pharmacy versus a payer, how many do I support? That's what I need to look at.
Cheryl, I know you have your hand raised.
Yeah, actually my hand was raised because I trying to see clearly, Hans, what the workflow would be that of what you're suggesting. So if it's a send and receive, the order would go out to the pharmacy. The pharmacy would then receive the order. Hopefully the patient then picks up the order, and what you would receive back from the payer would be a claim, because that's all the payer is going to have. And if the order's never been picked up, you won't get anything from the payer. So, you know, it's a little different than the prior auth, because the prior auth is dealing with information passing between the provider and the payer. This is really more of a three-pronged branch instead of the two-pronged. So, you know, not that the patient doesn't have a role in a prior auth, but in a prior auth, the request is going to go to the payer, and then there's going to be information exchange, and then there'll be a response in terms of approval. So kind of like, is that what you're thinking here?
So it depends on the which flow we're talking about. If we're talking about prior auth, is that there is clearly the ordering provider. They need to get the authorization for that. There's the payer grants that. The question is that as part of the communication to the pharmacy that's going to fill, is it ever going to arrive there? Or when it arrives, it needs to have the appropriate authorization information in there. So there are three parties involved, but not to the same extent necessarily. I think we don't need to figure out exactly what fits where, with Rotodebt if we recognize that a workflow has one, two, or three, or whatever the number is, but in this case, two or three key participants in there, that having a criteria focused on each one of those for that capability as it's being done in prior auth in G34, 35, if it, as it's done in F1 through 29, that concept would be very helpful to apply here as well.
Okay, I'm getting it now. All right, thank you. I just was having a little trouble visualizing it, so I appreciate that expanded conversation.
And Margaret, I see you put the comment in the chat, but was there anything you wanted to add to that? If not, then we'll go to Ike, who has his hand raised.
Yeah, I think two pieces are true. One, looking at any return from the far or when the prescription has been picked up, there should also be feedback back to the ordering provider so that the provider's aware that it's been picked up. Secondly, I'm not all that familiar with prior auth in medications. From a patient perspective, it seems a little weird, to be honest, that prior auth would come from the pharmacy or come from the pharmacy to the payer, not from the ordering provider to the payer. Because then if there needs to be a substitute medication, it seems that that would be an extra few steps to get the prescription actually, or a useful prescription actually fulfilled. I know that's out of scope, I'm just making that as an observation that may be out of scope for this rule.
Cheryl?
I think, Steve, that's where I was stuck here, because typically that's the way I saw it. It prior auth would go between the payer and the provider, but then when the prior auth for the prescription is approved, that's when the prescription goes to the prescribing pharmacy. So I didn't see it as a separate entity, I guess. And I do agree that if, Hans, what you're saying is the same workflow application that we're looking at for overall prior auths should be applied to prescriptions, that makes sense. But because when you were first talking, I thought you were thinking of something different, but please correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you're talking about really kind of applying the same logic to the real-time benefit check.
We can do that there. We can do it to the prior auth in anyone where there is actually not just a simple submission and you're done, or a simple query and you're done, but that there's interaction back and forth in particular. But even if there is a submission, we have seen with public health, there is the ability to set, submit or report, and there is the ability to receive, and it has certain responsibilities. So I think what we're looking at is that take the workflow, look at the key sides of it. If it's two, it's two. If it's three, based on the flow, it's three. Whatever it is, take the same approach of splitting up the criteria in both parts, so you can more clearly articulate upon sending by that party or upon receipt by that other party, what are they supposed to support? What's the standard? Are there any other requirements that are in play? And that we can be more specific at that.
Okay, so just to make sure I'm following, so I'm changing the wording here. It's to take this recommendation and split it like we did in, or not like we did, but like it already was in rows 29 and 30, where you have, if you can scroll up, Sarah, I think rows 29 and 30 show two different rows for the two different roles of provider and payer. So Hans, is that the gist of the recommendation?
I think so, yes. Okay. And then details about, okay, what is it exactly? I'm not convinced we need to discuss those here, but that can then be part.
Does that splitting of the recommendation to both sides apply to both 39 and 40?
I generally would say yes, but the more complex the workflow is, the more important it is. But when we see that there are multiple parties like public health and the provider, if we see that, we have a couple of other ones as well. We have the provider API in the payers, where it's a quote unquote a simple query, but it's also split up. I think it's a general good practice. I think it's a great direction that is to be started with, and would be helpful to apply it wherever we can.
Yeah. And maybe from my own learning from task force members, I'm learning from the chat, Margaret, it looks like there are cases where Medicaid will allow a pharmacy to submit the prior auth. Does a pharmacy fall under the notion of a provider, or do we need to call something out separately for pharmacies, or are pharmacies like totally out of scope for certification of health IT? Does anyone know?
I have a response to that or a reaction, but there has been an effort within high tech to address pharmacy and pharmacists on how they fit. That was last year, among a variety of comments that included the interest for certification in that space as well. That does not mean that where ONC, I think, and that's my understanding, ONC can define the criteria, but other programs would identify who actually needs to adhere to that or not, like CMS with their programs to incent providers to adopt certified software, and that's how it's being done. That would have to be defined as well. We have similarly with interactions with payers, with public health, et cetera. So, but the steps are being taken here that there is recognition of two sides of the equation or three sides. So if there's a pharmacist was recognized that is a kind of a provider, are they the ordering provider in this sense? Can they be that? And they would take on that role. Is it something that they receive a script from a ordering provider and then they're the one actually submitting the authorization, not the ordering provider? They would have that role as some form of performer. So I think that's what we're trying to tease out and have clarity around, that then a pharmacist needs to be able to support as a pharmacist. But when are they a ordering provider? That's a good question. But this kind of approach would help with that, because a system might cover both.
So that was the timer for row 40. Other than splitting the recommendation, are there other things that we want to incorporate into changes? If not, then we can go to row 39, and Sarah, we can start another timer for this one. But I'm not too worried about time because I feel like they're related.
I agree. But we can start it. I think we have 20 minutes for this one, but then a remaining 20 minutes. So if it goes over, that's okay too.
Okay. So row 39 is the prescription benefit. Any recommendations from folks? Obviously, I just pulled over the concept of splitting the recommendation to the payer and provider, but anything else for this one?
Similar question on RT, on the real-time benefits. Yes, the splitting. In the prior auth, there was clarification that there is Part B that's already requiring that. Is there something similar for RT, for real-time benefits as well? Or is this a new territory for everybody from a clarification perspective?
Does anyone have the answer to that?
Is there, the question is there a corresponding requirement on the payer side?
Correct.
Yes.
Go ahead.
And
so CMS has had a requirement for Part D plans in regulation since 2019 that they need to establish real-time benefit tools that can be used by prescribers. They separately have a requirement about real-time benefit tools that can be used by patients as part of the legislation that I mentioned in 2021. It specified that they needed to name a standard for that. And so now they have added to that regulatory requirement that Part D plans, as they're establishing these real-time benefit tools, need to comply with the NCPDP standard adopted here. So that exists on the Part D side.
Thank you. Yeah, so that would then also here provide that same balance by splitting this up as we did for prior auth. There's the CMS interop and prior authorization rule that requires payers to do something in that space. This would then provide the underpinning from a certification perspective to enable other programs to pick that up whenever they're ready for that. So it seems a good symmetry to have there.
So is that captured in the comment I added in G, Hans?
Yeah, I think that's analogous. So, yeah.
Any other recommendations we want to make to the proposal in row 39? So I'll put that in the worker recommendation. So Sarah, I think if we're done with 39 and 40, we'll want to use some time to go back over.
Yeah. Yes. Are there any that you, any ones in particular? I think there was one that Cheryl wanted to discuss, if I remember correctly, she wasn't able to get to last week.
Yes, that's correct. It was, there's two things. Hans and I offline talked about the one that I did talk about, and I did amend the wording in there, which hopefully will be more palatable for the group. But the second one was about, I have to look at, is this the one recommended? See, add, hold on, requires, okay. This is the one we did talk about, the one you're showing right now. Okay. The one that we didn't talk about, and this is the one where we amended the wording over on the right. Yeah. The one we didn't talk about is in a lower row. It was row 24, row 24.
Yeah.
And this was the one that was talking about the need for, and I guess this goes beyond the rule according to my conversation with Hans, but I feel like we should comment anyway on it, because at the end of the day, we have in many forums talked about issues with patients, A, being able to correct their records, and B, adding to their records with data from other providers, which would need to be supported electronically. And today there is no way of doing that. And I guess one read that I took of the patient access API is that, yes, it primarily was targeted at payers, but there's no reason why payers should be the only ones that have to provide data when the patient knows there's data that providers have, why can they not use the same type of transaction to request that provider share their data with them, and then they can share it again back to another provider? And this happens a lot when you have individuals that have chronic conditions and also sometimes rare conditions. And so they're primarily getting care at one setting, which might be closer to where they live, and then they have to go get care at another setting that's further away. Getting that those records shared and trying to put all of that stuff in place. Yes, implementing some of the things we've talked about overall with HTI too will help. But at the end of the day, there's no opportunity with the software for the patient to be the ones to say, this is the information that needs to go from provider A to provider B, because I just had a whole host of tests there. For instance, if a patient went to somewhere like the Mayo Clinic, where they go for a week and they get all these comprehensive things, and now they want to share it back with a local provider, there's no way for them to do that electronically, and there should be. So, and they shouldn't be forced to have to use a third-party app to do that if they don't want to. They should be a way in their patient portal or something, the patient app that's provided, for them to say, we need to get this data and move it over. And that's all I'm saying. If we're looking at interoperability and satisfying the goals that we have in the patient access rule, as well as this rule and the additional new rules with prior authorization, they all speak around it, but they don't speak to a specific process to accomplish it. And today there's no way for a patient to do that. That's the problem.
Hans?
Yes, Mark. There actually are some, but we can certainly discuss are they sufficient or not. But there is, as part of certification, there's the view, download, transmit criterion that enables a patient to send it to somebody else. That could be that other provider. So there are some.
That may be there, Hans, but there's no... in multiple software patient portals, there's no request, there's no process for the patient to actually make that work. So it may be part of the certified health IT software, but there's no requirement that says it has to be made available to the patient. That's the problem. And I don't know the right way to say it, maybe I'm saying it wrong, but that's the issue. It may be present in the software, but it's not available to the patient.
And to add on to that, this is Steve again, to add on to it, there's no way of doing it remotely where it is. In other words, you the patient have to go to whatever portal the data actually exists in to request it to be pushed, not looking at a request. So I can't go to my PCP and say, hey, there's data over there, go grab it, or to my PCP's portal and say, go grab it over there. I've got to go chase around to all the different places it exists and tell them to push it over, which means I've got to spend more time rather than going to a single hub and enabling requesting data from all the other places where I know it is.
And Mark, if I may add some additional thoughts from earlier. So there is some capability, but as I indicated, we can certainly address that it might not be sufficient, and you've given some good examples of that, where we need to look at some of that. We need to look at and say, is that part of certification, or is there other places that that needs to sit? Because we're now looking also at implementation provider perspective of it. So that we want to have a couple of other thoughts there. The use of the patient API and the ability there would not necessarily seem to be the right place, because the intent there, as I understand it, and has been also in the CMS rule as described, it's query access to. And that's what it's mimicking. So perhaps there needs to be a recommendation that may not be attainable in HCI2, but to identify capabilities that further enhance on the ability of a patient to initiate transfer of data from one provider to the next, where there's interest in that. They may not be connected by the same network or otherwise, so we have to think through what that works to address that concept, which is not the same as I think the impression of some of the comments might have been, is that a patient can write into the EHR. It is actually asking or requesting that a provider A is sharing information with a specific provider B in an appropriate form. And at that point in time, it would flow in a similar fashion as that currently transitions of care are actually done, and it is another form of how to initiate a transition of care. Should that be limited to providers only that do that, or should that be expanded to patients being able to initiate that where they feel that certain data is not yet shared?
So let me,
Cheryl,
before I come back to you though, I want to ask a naive question, because I think the ideal way that this would work is that you can automatically push data between systems to update patient records to be more comprehensive. But I guess at a very basic level, do we even have identifiers in place to accurately do record linkage?
There's data being used that when data is being shared to help in the matching process.
But like,
process is not necessarily always 100% accurate based on the available information. It's probabilistic, deterministic, a variety of levels that are being used, but there's not a singular unique identifier that everybody shares. But there is matching, and as a result, ability to share data and associate with another record, but it has its shortfalls.
But like, Hans, let me just give a concrete example. So I'm at Duke, UNC is a few miles down the road. If there's records from Mark Sendak at both, I understand that it may be tedious for me to go get them from one place and give them to a provider at the other place to update my records. But I guess I'm just trying to understand, do we have the linkages to automatically combine them if I authorized both systems to do that?
I'm not sure whether, and I see Cheryl's hand, so I don't want to jump in, but respond directly to that. That's what the HIEs, the networks are all focusing on, so that mostly right now query-based, where there's an interest from a provider to get information from other providers, where they pull it in, and then there is a good discussion to be had about how does the push model and how does the patient-initiated push fit into that, but they all are based on using methods to match patients across networks or across providers, using the networks to make that happen better. Because if we just do it with between the two, their medical record numbers are clearly not in sync between those two, and they have to do it on the demographic data that's available. That's what networks are really keenly focusing on to improve upon that. So is there information to use with matching? Yes. Is it perfect matching? No. But there are abilities to exchange in a variety of different forms. Direct messaging, network-based queries, direct messaging, you can do it directly, send it to the other party. It includes the information on the patient. Can the direct message be initiated by the patient? Verbally, perhaps, but if you have it in another form, as Cheryl described, not necessarily. So I think those are the areas that we would need to look at and see whether they fit. I'm personally not convinced it's part of patient API based on the current definition, but it is a capability that high tech can recommend, and I would support the notion of we need to look at that, see what other ways there are to enhance that ability. What do we have, and what else needs to be added to make that better? But there is not nothing.
Yep. Cheryl, go ahead.
Yes, so I just wanted to clarify, and thank you, Hans, for you know, having that expanded conversation, because I think that did help. But often what patients find, and I know this for sure with examples that I have seen, they will share data electronically with their providers between one system and another, even uploading it to the portal through messages, et cetera, but that data never makes it into the EHI. So to me, I wasn't looking for direct messaging, but there needs to be an electronic way that patients can request data be shared from one provider to another. And then also there needs to be something in the rule that requires that data that the patient has shared at least be evaluated to be become part of their EHI, because in both cases, that's not happening. And it may be that there's capabilities, but they're not being utilized that way. And maybe that's part of the reconciliation function we talked about a couple weeks ago. I don't know, because this is where, you know, I'm beyond my knowledge of what happens in an EMR system. But I know in the this rule and the prior auth rule, part of the rule was to require that not only payers share data, but they actually use the data that they get in order to make it part of the patient's EHI. So to me, this is the same. It needs to be applied the same standard.
Hans?
Yeah, it would seem as that there are a couple of different places across which we need to look. What scope of reconciliation? Because once you receive it, how do you ingest it? In that context, we need to recognize the difference between I receive a data set or a document, I have it, but I'm not going to further parse it apart. I keep it as a document and I make that available for viewing purposes, versus I'm taking data out of it as well, and integrate that further into the record. That's the reconciliation part, where you can look at and say, the document contains five allergies. Some of those are new, some of those you already know about. Reconciliation is about picking up the new things that are relevant and putting them in the record. Those capabilities are there, but the reconciliation criteria to expand that would look at additional data for which you would have to do that. But that doesn't mean that the document that was sent is then gone. It can be there for viewing as a document, but not necessarily the data individually, discreetly. And other parts of how do you initiate the data is done. Currently, we have query capabilities from one provider to another. Well, what's the role of a patient requested sharing of the data, whatever format we might land at? So I think there are different places to look at to say, the ability for a patient to share, and to what extent is it integrated into the target EHR, we would need to understand what is the piece that needs to be added to each one of those.
So I'm trying to figure out where, this is a pretty high level conversation in terms of the types of functionality that we're trying to advance. Is like row 24 the best place for this recommendation, or where's the best place to tie this to? And Cheryl, given that you were the first one to kind of point us here.
Yeah.
Or Ike, were you going to say something?
Sorry, no.
But Cheryl, I was going to ask you. Do you think
I have to open the spreadsheet? But I think I aligned it to this particular section because it pertains to essentially the patients and what I aligned it to was the patient APIs. And I guess, you know, it could be aligned to reconciliation. It could be aligned to another area. But again, I don't know if I'm the best one to say what area. What I did try to do is go through all this rule, the patient access rule, and the prior auth rule to identify where it was supported. And I tried to include that in my justification for the recommendation, but the recommendation itself is really only the first paragraph. So, but I do think based on what Steve was saying, maybe the link, and, you know, I don't want to be using this to solutionize, but, you know, there is individual access services that are going to be offered through TEFCA. Maybe the magic is that certified health IT needs to provide an electronic way to access those so the patient can initiate that request for the data to be shared. You know, I don't know, but to me, this is the most important aspect of what the patient needs from these rules, because what they're thinking is that we're implementing interoperability, which means that they have access to their data, you know, where they need it, when they need it, and how they need it. And today, what I'm saying is, in reality, maybe those capabilities exist, but they're not always accessible by the patient. And I'm working hard to try to figure out what are the gaps and how can we fill them.
No, and really appreciate that. So I think definitely we're going to try to figure out, and my sense is if we include this in one place and ONC wants to incorporate it in somewhere else, I think that's fine. Hans.
Perhaps a location suggestion, given that at least our read of the patient API aligning with the CMS patient API is payer focused. So it's the payer consumer interaction. It's not provider focused. So from an EHR perspective, we are not looking at how we would provide a patient API. We're looking at other ones like G10, G20, the A-series, et cetera, et cetera. That's where we're looking at the capabilities between the provider and the patient. So some of the ones to consider where it could tie to, there are the A criteria around coordination of care, transitions of care. Granted, they today focused on the provider, but that would be a place where one we could suggest, and whether it lands there or not, different story, but that the progression of that care coordination, this is patient-initiated care coordination, the need for the patient to identify, I'd like you to share it with provider X. And then it starts to flow through and picks up on, it arrives there, and then there's reconciliation that occurs, and that's where the question comes up. Is all the data that is relevant being ingested and reconciled, which means this great data is being pulled out and integrated into the record, is that happening to the extent that that is appropriate or of interest? So I think that's more the focus where from the provider-patient relationship, where we see the criteria that touch upon that, not the patient API that is payer-focused. Doesn't mean that perhaps there is a opportunity or a need that a patient can ask the payer who has the data to please share it with provider X. I'm not saying that. And if there is that interest, then that might be another place to focus on the payer's capabilities to support that. So I think it is not necessarily one at this point in time. It might not necessarily end up in extending those criteria, but creating new criteria to really hone in on that aspect. But those would seem to be some of the hooks and to link it to.
Hans, would that be row 7?
Let me jump to row 7 to be able to read that. Row 7 is around dynamic. No, that would not be it. That's a very technical.
You said G20, which is where I landed there.
G10, but that's not dynamic client registration protocol. Is actually J. When is it 15? Uh-huh. I'm not sure the numbers, but. That's part of G10. G10 has its own. G10 could perhaps be looked at because that's patient access. I would say it's less. It would not resonate with me as much if we did it in care coordination. B2 and B3.
B2 and B3. So let's figure out.
B3 are the creation, the transition of care, where the patient may want to be the one that initiates it, have in particular things. The reconciliation is the receipt of that. That is a little bit more CDA focused at this point in time. That's where currently that kind of transfer would occur. There's other ones as well, but.
How about row 6? That's B2. Sarah, can you scroll up a little bit and then to the left?
Row 6?
Yeah, user access.
Maybe I'm looking at the wrong row 6, because I'm seeing end user brands and endpoints. That would also be a technical thing. It would be a criterion A, B, 1 and 2, wherever they are in the spreadsheet.
Is that 30?
It looks more like 14 from what he's telling me, if I'm understanding it.
14? No, that's a J. It would be wherever B. There are updates to B1 and B2 to use more current.
So 34 is B2. That's the clinical information reconciliation.
Yeah, and then there is the other one where it is about new imaging requirements. That's against B1.
Interesting.
So from a, it's not specific to new imaging.
Sorry, that's 33 and 34. I misread it. I need better glasses.
Yeah. But those two relate back to B1 and B2.
Yeah.
And B1 and B2 for the intent of the patient initiating sharing of information. Initial reaction would be that's probably the closest criteria to hook it to, recognizing that what is being suggested might not really fit totally inside those two. I actually would suspect it doesn't, but it's still, it's in the space of care coordination. I want my data to be shared with somebody else.
And just to pause for a moment, I want to get some folks from ONC. I don't know, Seth, if this is something you can speak to. I know there is an interoperability subgroup. Do you feel like this is something that group is kind of addressing?
Yeah, the interoperability standards work group would, primarily focuses on the US CDI versioning. But does do some additional standards work. But from a requirement standpoint, in the rule, it would be, this group.
Okay. So then let's try to put something at least in 34. And Cheryl, I know that you said it was like the first paragraph from what you had written in 7.
Yeah, I can move it down and rewrite it. Based on what we discussed today, I'll do that after this meeting.
That would be fabulous. So okay, I'll just make a note in row, I'll say, for Cheryl.
Thank you, Mark.
No problem. Was there another one you wanted to look at from last time?
Well, I did rewrite the other one, which was the first one that you put up, based on the network discussion that we had. And I think we modified it to the degree that I think hopefully will be something that's can be accomplished. But let me tell you what row it is so I can find it myself, because I okay, so it's row 7.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so and if you go over, I guess what I modified was in G. All right, so basically what we updated was recommend that ONC add a requirement for certified health IT to that requires certified health IT vendors to demonstrate a successful data exchange with a network, either local HIE or national. And just listed examples, EHX, TEFCA, or Care Quality, for example, in alignment with data exchange, privacy, and security. This certification step will ensure efficient data exchange and support interoperability goals across the healthcare ecosystem, which I have to fix my misspellings, and enable even smaller providers that purchase certified health IT products to achieve data interoperability goals with minimal burden. The revised regulations related to information blocking and the finalized definition of Offer Health IT aligns to establishing a successful demonstration of network data exchange to prevent conditions that hinder interoperability. And then currently major EMR vendors already demonstrate the successful ability to complete network data exchange based on their participation in HIEs and national networks. But many of the more out of the box vendors do not demonstrate this capability, and it hinders smaller providers to complete connections as they do not have the technical expertise or resources to perform these connections and support from, and I'll fix that, the certified health IT vendors, in many cases is limited or non-existent. Also, we need to include greater, and I'll fix this, again, misspelled, reporting at the certified health IT website for organizations to report issues with certified health IT products related to data exchange connectivity. I would also recommend that ASTP increase their audit capabilities of certified health IT to ensure certified health IT products are prepared for audits when necessary. Because actually, you know that if you look at it and you people are worried you're going to look at it, then they're going to be sure to do it versus certify something that doesn't happen. The other thing is with the certification criteria that exist today, when they do a demonstration of a network connection, typically they have to explain how they did the process. And that documentation would be very helpful for a provider who wants to work with an HIE or TEFCA even to connect, and they can't get support from the vendor to understand what hurdles they had to overcome in order to make that connection. Today, I understand in the certified health IT website, you have to say if a third-party software or some integration software was required, but it's limited in terms of if there's other things that need to be done in order to make that data connection work. And where we see this falling apart from a payer's perspective, we've actually been working with HIEs and others to try to enable some of these smaller providers, is they're not getting the support they need from the vendor. And today, all the pressure is on the provider for information blocking, et cetera. There's no pressure on the vendor who sold them the product to actually support that product and ensure that they can make a connection. And again, it's not the top ones, it's the other ones that mm-hmm. we're seeing this happen.
Cheryl, can you say the first eight words again?
The first eight words? Yeah.
Yeah, 10 words.
Sorry, they're there. Can you see them now?
No, it's really, really small on my screen.
Okay. It's recommend that ONC add a requirement for certified health IT. And again, I have to fix this, to require certified health IT vendors to demonstrate a successful data exchange with a network, either
okay. local or okay. That's yeah. friendly amendment. If I might jump right in front, I think you might want to include that as a recommendation as far as what the certification criterion might be, rather than adding a requirement. Because we need to stay within the context of the rule in our comments. So if you're looking at trying to modify the rule to have a new requirement, that might be out of scope because they can't include things that weren't included in the rule. However, if a recommendation were to be something about the inclusion of a factor in the certification criterion that comes into effect underneath the rule, that might be in scope. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes sense, and I'll update the recommendations. Stephen, thank you for that.
Sorry, Hans.
No worries. No. Along those lines, I think that that same comment as you go through the patient-initiated coordination of care transition of data, may want to look at that as well, see where there is a better spot, because that's more likely to, currently not to fit otherwise clearly into what's there. But I put in the column next to it just a small suggestion on the first paragraph that that otherwise reads very clear and appreciate the updates there. That since TEFCA and Care Quality are frameworks, not actual networks, and that local state HIEs, eHealth Exchange, Commonwealth, number of other ones, they are actual networks that you actually physically connect to. A suggestion to look at those examples and then any other network under Care Quality or TEFCA, because there are many other ones that they could demonstrate it with.
And one question also for Seth, if we have a recommendation, but if it doesn't cleanly fit into a row in the workbook, how do we?
Yeah, we just, yeah, just add a row.
At the bottom.
If you have like an overall recommendation, yeah, you can just add an additional row. Okay. And we can work on, it could just be like an overall recommendation if there's not a specific provision it's, you know, connecting to.
And so just to kind of recap your comment, Stephen, it sounds like we would adapt this to not be add a requirement, but add, like, update a certification criteria to require that the health IT vendor can demonstrate the successful data exchange. Is that correct?
Right, or include in certification criterion under the rule XYZ.
Okay. Cheryl, do you want to also take the lead on just updating this, including the language from Hans?
Yes, I will do both. And then I'll update the language of the other one based on that advice as well. I think that's a good direction. Thank you.
And Cheryl, if there's anything I can do to help, please feel free to reach out. Happy to do so, but I don't want to interfere with your excellent thoughts either.
No worries. Thank you, Stephen. Appreciate it.
And Cheryl, just move it to the bottom. I think don't try to jerry-rig where it fits.
Okay.
So, and Hung?
In that same vein, what I've been thinking about is some kind of providing clients a way to provide feedback on the actual performance or functionality of the certified IT. If you think about it, the FDA has a mechanism whereby you can report issues with devices and drugs. And there's not a similar mechanism currently for the ONC to collect or to be able to evaluate these and weigh them as part of certification. So in the same vein, could I then add that as a certification criteria that to collect and provide feedback from clients on the performance of their software as part of certification requirement?
So let me use more FDA language.
Okay.
Maybe Hans, I know that you work a lot with the EHR Association. Like, is there post-market performance monitoring for EHRs where there's any reporting, whether it's to ONC or elsewhere, to give some public visibility?
There is insights as a part of the rule where there are certain measures that need to be reported on. Is it at the level of post-market as FDA does? I don't think so, but it's certainly that, and there's real-world testing. I would defer to ONC what level of public insights they would be. I'm personally not, as other folks are, but I'm not personally as familiar what is publicly shared versus what we are required to report and do post certification. So insights and real world testing are two key examples there.
In Hung, I compare it to post market because it's like even after you're certified, you want to see how things work. So if you can add that to the bottom as well, I think we would have to confirm with ONC, Seth, and I know we just have like 40 seconds, but is that something that we could frame as in scope for this feedback, or would it be determined as out of scope?
I mean, to be in scope, it would have to connect to some, you know, overarching proposal. I mean, as a task force, you can, and as the high tech can put forward, you know, any recommendations, you know, you see fit, but from a logical outgrowth standpoint to be addressed in the final rule, it would have to connect to some proposal. So it'd really be up to you how you know, how the task force and the committee wants to move forward on that.
Row 42 has insights. And I'm looking for real world, because I thought there were changes to that as well. Real world, is it dash or not? We'll find out. Yeah, there's a dash in there. I think there's a row for that as well somewhere. So I believe there were some changes there. Maybe that did not change because things move into that at that point in time. But so there's a real section.
I know we're at the public comments. So we'll get to 42 next week. So it looks like next week we may be able to work that in. So thank you, everybody.
All right, thank you. So we're gonna move to public comment. So if you are on the Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the raise hand function, which is located on your Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you are participating by phone only today, you can press *9 to raise your hand. And then once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your line. And so when we pause to allow folks to queue up, just want to make the reminder that the next and final Group 2 meeting for the HTA2 proposed rule task force is going to be next Wednesday on August 28th from 11 to 12:30 Eastern time. And then after that, we'll be transitioning to full task force meetings for the week of Labor Day with meetings scheduled on the September 3rd, 4th, and 5th. So I will check any folks on the line. So no folks on the line. And let me just check if anyone is on Zoom. No, so no public comments at this time. So Mark, back to you for next steps and to close this out.
Sorry, I was muted. Thank you everybody for the discussion today. We'll meet next week on the 28th. So it'll be on Wednesday at our normal time, 11 to 12:30. We'll go through the last section, try to fill some gaps from other sections of the proposed rule. So appreciate everybody's time. I think we'll adjourn.